Session number 27345, Reel 4.
So still in Reel 4. What was your pay when you started in the Navy?
7 shillings per week. And I had to make 3 and 6 pence to my mother. So I had 3 and 6 pence a week.
And you mentioned some of the things you could spend that on. Were you ever allowed ashore?
Oh yes. You were allowed to go ashore in Chatham. You could go to the pictures. Things like that. Or... We weren't allowed all night leave, not while we were training, because we were sprocs. So you weren't allowed all night leave, but you was allowed till 11 o'clock at night, and you had to be in. So that was all right. But all you had was the 3 and 6 months per week, but you couldn't go ashore very very much because you didn't have a lot to spend. Because by the time you had a cup of tea and a cake and all this sort of business, your 3 and 6 months didn't go all that far, you see. But when you went on leave, because you used to get a cheap ticket from Chatham, naval ticket, and you used to come home on 24 hours leave off till 9 o'clock the next morning, 4 o'clock in the afternoon till 8 o'clock the next morning. And I used to catch the old early morning train at 5:30 from Mottingham, and that used to say it's right to the chap. It was the Matlow special.
When you went to shore, what was, you mentioned the cinema, was there an Aggie Westerns in Chatham?
There was an Aggie Westerns, and a lot of us went to the Aggie Westerns.
Can you describe to me what Aggie Westerns was?
It was a place where you could go and you could spend the night. When you got shore leave, all night leave, if you wanted to go ashore and sleep ashore, you used to go into Aggie Westerns and you book a bed. But you could also get food and everything else. Not only that, you could also go into the lounges and you could sit in nice armchairs and read books and things like that and see what was going on.
Was there any element of religious instruction there at all?
I never came across it at all. Although religion was based in there, they did not try to... shall I say, press it on you. You was allowed to do it yourself. And if you was there on a Sunday morning and service was being held, you were quite welcome to go in. I did go in 2 or 3 times to the service in there.
How was it looked upon by the majority of sailors?
As a blessing. It was somewhere to go. It was a change. See, in the barracks... Navy. Everywhere you look is Navy. Suits. Men in dressed as Navy. Orders. Chief Petty Officer. Don't do this, don't do that. Walk, run. When you got into Aggie Westerns, you was relieved, sort of, innit? You could relax. You wasn't on your toes all the time. But when you was in the barracks, being trained, in training, you was on your toes all the time. That's how you got like that.
And what was Chatham like as a Navy town?
Normal town, I suppose. But lots of the places there where the women used to be, you know, sort of business for men to go and visit. But on the whole, I suppose it was just the same as what Portsmouth was. Portsmouth was a naval town. A lot of it, Navy was in it, and the same as in Chatham. With the Aggie Westerns and the Taylors, 50 Bob Taylors, and all this. And a lot of it was for naval. The shops had naval stuff with them. But on the whole, it was very well. Buses used to run from Chatham Barracks to the town. No problem.
So how much would you say the economy really relied on the Navy?
Well, of Chatham Town, a very, very, a lot. Because, not from me, from being a being trained, not while I was being trained, but from the older sailors that couldn't get home and everything else, it did put quite a lot of economy into Chatham. Because a lot of them used to go ashore. You've got pictures and things like that, and into the pubs, of course. Of course, the pubs did a good trade, and so did the places for eating, the cafes and everything else. Because they used to go and have a meal in here, egg and chips, bacon and chips, sausage and chips, and so forth.
And would a lot of them retire to the kind of the big naval towns?
I don't think so. Mostly outside of the naval town. Mostly outside. Not actually in the naval town, but it was outside in the surrounding districts they went.
So you've done your training there. You've been selected as the ordinary
seaman.
What was the next stage?
I got a draft. I was drafted to HMS Ivanhoe.
Where was she when you were drafted to her?
She was in Malta. I went out on a troop car from Portsmouth.
How did you discover what your draftings were? What would they do?
Down in the drill hole, the drafts used to go up every day. Outside the drafting office, lists used to go up, and that's where you found out. Once you passed your training, every day you went down into the drill hole, you always looked on the drill hole board to see who the drafts were. Of course, I looked on there, and lo and behold, T.A. Chilton, HMS Ivanhoe. So I reported that into the drafting office, and they said, right, you'll be going out on a troop carrier to Malta. She's in Malta. I said, what? I would remember it. He said, yes, she's in Malta. Oh, God. I said, on my own? He said, yes. I said, you're going on a troop carrier. He said, but, he said, there'll be a lot of sailors on there. He said, so don't worry yourself. And he said, go and get your kit. Start getting your kit in order. He said, you'll muster down here in 4 days' time with your kit ready to go. I said, where will I go then? He said, you're going to Portsmouth. He said, you'll go by train to Portsmouth. He said, the lorry will be here to pick you up and take you and your kit bag and your hammock, take you to the station. You'll go to Portsmouth and you'll pick up the troop ship at Portsmouth. And that's where I went then. And I picked up the troop ship. I think it took about 16 or 18 days, I think, to get to Malta. And when I got in Malta, I was landed on the wharf. Of course, there was all the GIs, gunners' mates and everything else, you know, calling out the names and everything else. Here, here. And my name was called, and there. And he went to the old boats that the Maltese used to run, the motorboats, you know, for leave, shore leave, because they used to do all that. And you put your gear on there, and you was transferred from the quayside to HMS Ivanhoe.
When you've been on the troop ship, going out there, did you have any duties really on board while you were there?
Yes, you was cook of the mess, you did mess duties and everything else, but no actual watching duties, nothing like that. But you weren't allowed to sit around all day. You still went to instructions. They still held classes for all the men there. So we still went to instructions, and we weren't let up in any way, in any shape or form. But we didn't do so many as though you were being in train, because you started about 9 o'clock till about 11:30. And then you had a good 2 hours or so for a meal. And then you might have had a couple of hours in the afternoon. And then the rest of the time was your own. But on board ship, a troop ship, you couldn't do much. And because you weren't allowed to go into the soldiers, in with the soldiers or anybody. So you was Navy, and you had to keep in with the naval mess.
You said when you'd gone that you'd gone out on your own. With the drafting system, did it work that everybody was drafted to different ships from your mess, who you trained?
Oh, yes. What happened was that we all went to different ships, and some went to other places. When we were finally categorised, and I was a seaman, so the others were drafted to other vessels as writers and things like that, and so forth and such which. Because the mess wasn't just only consisted of sailors, it consisted of writers and everybody else, you see.
But it was unusual for two people to go to the same ship.
Very unusual, very unusual. I went on with Todd. I was the only one.
So you'd arrived in Malta, mm-hmm. You got on board the ship. What were your initial impressions of her?
I thought she looked lovely, but she was spick and span. And when you went up the gangplank, there's the officer of the watch up there, and the petty officer of the day, and of course the boss name master. And as you walk on, the petty officer says, "Turn aft and salute." Because first time you were told that you had to do it, but you were told directly you got on board ship what to do in case you did it wrong. And so you turned aft, saluted, and then you gave your name and number, reporting, and you said, and the petty officer of the day said, "Right, you've been allocated EMS. You will be shown." And along comes somebody who says, "Come on, I'll take you." And so you get introduced into the mess.
And can you give me a description of the ship? What she was like, her characteristics, what she was armed with, how many men she carried?
She carried 140 odd men. She had four 4.7 guns, A and B, X and Y. And she had 10 torpedo tubes in two banks of five, amidships. And also between the two funnels, she had anti-aircraft guns, and she did look a fighting ship, and of course after she had all the depth charges all the way around the stern, the depth charges, and she had guns everywhere, anti-aircraft guns, all up on little stanchions by the side of the bridge, and everywhere else were these guns just sticking out, and they were all anti-aircraft guns. But there were 4.7 guns.
And what class of ship was she?
Ivano, she was called the I-boat destroyer. She was capable of doing 38 knots, which was a tidy old speed then. And actually all the I-boats, the Ivano, Icarus, Intrepid, Impulsive, all of those were all capable of doing between 36 and 38 knots. And that was one of the reasons why I found out eventually why we were made into high-speed mine laying destroyers. That's what we was converted over for. And we was converted over to mine laying destroyers in Malta Dockyard.
How modern were the I-boats?
Very modern at the time. They were one of the modern boats. The next modern boat were the tribal caste destroyers. They took over from us. They took over from us. The Cossack and all those, all them I-boats. Because they were very distinctive with their bow. We had a sharp bow like that, but the tribal caste had a cut-in bow with a point to it. So it was just, yeah.
So you'd been introduced to the ship, you were sent to your mess.
Mm.
Can you describe the mess to me on board Ivanhoe? What a mess would look like on board a destroyer?
Right, first of all, it's up the bows of the ship. Like that, goes right down. In front, you've got the cable locker, where the locker for the cable, the anchor, is stowed in. So that is right close up to the front. There's a bulkhead there. Then from that bulkhead down, you've got the messes. But right in the middle, you've got the support for A-gun. Because A-gun is above domestics, and you've got to have a support. So it's all supported from that deck to the next deck. Then all the way around the outside of the boat like that, are all the lockers and a cage or a rack for your ditty box and your hat box. And your kit is stowed in the locker that you sit on. And there is a table in front of that. That goes around like that. The table's in front of it. Seats, mostly 12 men. 12. Some were 16, but mostly were 12. And then there would be a stool that would be bolted to the deck. So you couldn't move it. It would be in line with the table. And the table would be bolted. They were removable, but they were bolted for safety. If you was at sea, they would roll and everything else. So they had to be bolted. And because you'd sit on the seat on your locker, and you'd have the table there. You didn't have a lot of room, because you couldn't. And then you, on the other side of the table would be this long stool. And for that will be in two sections, one there, one there. And they, as I say, they're bolted, but they are removable. Because you have to move them when you wash the decks, when you wash the corkscrew floor. You have to lift them up, because otherwise they've all got dirt around them.
And the tables, are they adapted at all for life at sea? There's
no ridges, nothing. They are white, hard scrubbed tables, but rough. Not smooth, not like this. They are white top tables, and you can see the grain. That's the only part they had for non-slipping. But you had nothing to go around the outside, nothing.
And where would you store your hammocks?
Up against the bulkhead would be a portioned off like that, and you would stow your hammock upright in there, and you get somewhere to about 30 or 40 hammocks in that little pen. And that would be up there, and one would be the other side. And the whole of the mess deck might have, 60, 70 men on it. All depends. All their hammocks would be stowed in there, in the front. So it would be, when you walked on the way onto the mess deck, you would see the stools, the table, the lockers, hat boxes, tiddy boxes. Right up the front, you would see neatly stacked hammocks.
And how are you? And how are you introduced to your messmates?
First of all, you'd be introduced to the lead in hand. Every mess had a lead in hand who was responsible for that mess and for them, the men in that mess. You would be introduced to him first, and then he would take over. Because the only person that's brought you to the mess is the messenger, because they were waiting for you. They knew you were coming, and that's it. You'd be introduced to the lead hand of the mess, and he would explain to you how the mess works, the duties of the men while they're in the mess deck, how you would become cook of the day, and who you'd be married up with to do, because it was always two of you, not one, two. And you would join so-and-so, you would be cook of the day, and you would be told where your locker is. He'd tell you the locker that's vacant for you, and right above your locker is the vacant space for your ditty box and your hat box. And you would unpack your kit, stow it in the, and you didn't have a lot of room. Believe you me, I was shown how to do it, because there were a couple of the old boys there. Come on, son, we'll show you. And they showed me how to twist this bit round there, twist that bit round there, so that it just set in. Then you could put, because sometimes if you didn't pack it right, you can put the lid down. The lid was up a bit, so make sure the lid went down. And from then on, then you started to get married into the mess. And then the next day, they had you to get into the mess that day, and about the food and so forth. Then you'd get the instructions from your leading hand when it was your job to be cook a mess with so and so. Then along would come the boatswain's mate, and he would give you your ship instructions, what you're going to do, who you'll be attached to, and everything else. And he was the man that you had to look up to, because he was the man that told you what you was going to do and where your action station was and everything else. My first action station was down in the Shell Room. He said, now don't get... I was remembering him. He said, now don't get frightened, son. He said, you're going to be down there. Because he took me down there. He showed me where it was. And he opened it up. He said, you don't have to go down there. He showed me. My heart sunk, I might tell you. I'm going to be right down there at the bottom of the ship. He said, you'll have about 2 or 3 other people with you. He said, you're not on your own. He said, but that's your action station for a start. And funny enough, that was my action station all the time I was on HMS Ivanhoe, even though I was attached to the flipping torpedo party. I still had to do my action station down there.
When you'd arrived in the mess, are all jobs divided out equally?
What?
Amongst your messmates?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The only person that doesn't do any mess duties is the leading hand. Now, you have, in the mess, you have a man, or sometimes it's the leading hand, but it's normally an old three badger, a bloke that's done 15, 16, 17 years in the Navy, and he knows all the answers and all the rigmarole. Because you're allowed to spend so much money on food, because you do your own, you don't have a sort of communal cook, where he cooks all chips one night, all this, that and another. You send up what you want in that mess. So there's four messes in. There was four mess decks, four messes in mess deck. Oh, no, one there, one there, one there, one there. Now, every one of those messes could have had something different. One could have had pot mess, shepherd's pie, anything. But you always had to clarify it with the cook first. And that was when he wanted chips and things like that. Is it all right for chips? Yes. And sometimes he'd say no because he'd already got his quota of messes to cook for. Because it wasn't only your messes. There was the stoker's mess. There was the wireless mess. There was the petty officer's mess. Chief petty officer's mess. They were all different messes. You see? And it was all on different angles. Stoker's mess was down one flight down and all this sort of business. And the telegraphist mess, they were all the bunting and everything else. They all had a different mess, you see. And of course, they all looked after themselves with their food. So, and you would have these three, you'd have this three badge old boy, and he would be saying, right, we're going to have this today, we'll have that tomorrow. And he would look after the mess for the whole month. And he would allocate the money what to buy from the mess. Right? And at the end of the month, if you never spent it all, you shared out the difference. If there was, if you say, for example, you was allocated £60, this is only just an example, and you only spent 50, you get £10 back, and you would get, you share that £10 amongst the 12 men. So some messes used to go into debt; they'd spent too much, and instead of getting anything back, they had to pay. Oh, I want £1 off you for your mess. You see? And that's how it worked. And that's what we used to do, you see? He would, right, we'll have this, that, and everything. And he would look after the whole supply of the mess for that month. And then when the writer came to calculate it all up, well, you had this, because he knew what you was buying all the time. I mean, you were bought a £7 tin of corned beef. And you'd use that to make a shepherd's pie. You have a £7 tin of corned beef, chop it all up, and then you put all the and you put a load of potatoes over like that, you see. And it all and of course that used to be a cheap one because £7 tin, but if you had chops, and each man probably had 2 chops, that was 24 chops, it'd be a little bit dearer than that £7 tin of corned beef. And that's how you worked the money out, you see, and that's how these old fellas used to work the money.
So you could get somebody who was not very good with looking after the mess budget?
There weren't many, because the man that did take over was always a well-badged old boy and he knew what he was doing.
Could that have caused a friction if there'd been a problem with always being over budget?
Oh, yeah, if at the end of the month suddenly he'd come around, or we've overspent, there might be a little bit of friction. Well, why? Why have we overspent? Well, you've had this, you had custard which you didn't use here, but you had custard here, and jelly and things like that, you see, which is a little bit of nice stuff. And if you didn't have it, a sweet one day, sometimes you didn't have sweets because you didn't want a sweet. I mean, for example, when you had pot mess, you used to go round the boy. You used to go round it twice. You'd have a plate full first, and then after everybody had their plate, there was more left. Who wants some more? And round you'd go again, and you'd have another ladle full, you see. And that's how it went. You didn't want a sweet because you'd had enough dinner. And that's how it worked.
And what's the name for that type of messing? Is there a name given to it in the Navy?
No, just ordinary messing. It's called contract messing now, I believe. It's the name now, but it was just ordinary messing then. The first part, we went to sea with the fleet, the Mediterranean fleet, did exercises, went into Alexandria, Egypt, all the fleet, rested. Then we were transferred to Palestine, the port of Haifa. Now the reason we went there was that we went on patrol, and the patrol was to stop Jewish immigrants getting into Palestine. That's how I get the Palestine medal. And we did that for 2 months.
What would that entail?
Patrolling the whole of the Palestine border, right the way round.
And on patrol, how long would you be out on patrol for? What would the duration be?
About 5 days, then in for three, and then out again, because the whole flotilla was involved. The whole flotilla of the I boats, as I call them, and our pennant was D-16, but they called them the I boats. Intrepid, Icarus, Isis, Impulsive, all them.
And on the patrols, did you actually find anything while they were?
We did have one little episode. We did find a small stack, and unfortunately, you put a boarding party on, and I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden there was a shot rang out. What had happened? One of the boarding party's revolver had fallen out of his holster and fired, and it shot him in the arm. And so, but we don't know how it happened, what he was doing, but that's all we was told, and that's what happened.
What would you be doing when this stopped the ship?
We would take on board the immigrants, you know, the people trying to get in, the Jewish people, and we would take them to Haifa, and then the army would take over. What happened to afterwards, I do not know.
What did it look like?
Well, just my ordinary Jews, just all long hair, and you know, as you recognise a Jew, and very well dressed, and they had cases with them as well, with their belongings. And of course, they were trying to get into Palestine as illegal immigrants. And of course, now Palestine is now Israel, isn't it? The powers to be, the French, British, and American, decided to give Palestine to the Israels, and that's why we've got the troubles. You can quite understand the Palestinians, what they're doing, and I don't agree with their. These bombs, that, you know, car bombs, I don't agree with this at all. Blowing themselves up, I don't agree with that. I think that's diabolical. But I can understand them fighting to get their country back, because it is their country, isn't it?
At that time, would it just have been a trickle of Jewish refugees you were dealing with?
But it was getting bad, because they weren't only coming into Haifa, they were going on lonely shores and getting in that way, and that's what we had to stop, you see. But we had one case, we did, but some of the other boats did find other boats with them trying to get in. And we came towards, we was there for 3 or 4 months patrolling, on and off. And then we returned to Malta round about July.